It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our talk about deja vu.
That's right. If you didn't listen to part one, go back and listen to part one, because this is definitely one of those pair of episodes where you need to experience them in order. But we kicked off by talking about some personal experiences with deja vu, and also getting into some of the rich variety that is to be found under the broad categorization of deja vu experiences. In this episode, we're going to kick off by really getting into some of the major theories and explanations for this thing called deja vu.
Right. So last time I cited there's a major paper on the research on deja vu that was published in 2003 by a researcher named Alan S. Brown. It was published in Psychological Bulletin, and we cited it last time talking about a lot of the common findings about deja vu, including the fact that it appears to be very strongly associated with stress and fatigue. The more tired and stressed out you are, the more likely you are to have a deja vu experience. The studies that show it associated with travel, people who travel are more likely to experience deja vu. The studies that show that certain drugs can apparently cause lots of deja vu. And then especially the fact that deja vu appears to decrease with age, that as you get older in life, you on average have fewer deja vu experiences, which I'm still finding interesting. I'm coming back to that one a lot. But yeah, so now we want to dive into the major theories and explanations. And my main guide on this is Brown's paper from 2003, where he reviews most of the existing research. There have been a few developments since then, and we'll talk about those later on. But there are basically several, there are like four main categories that Brown outlines about what the explanations for deja vu could be. And the categories are going to be the following. So first, you got some kind of dual processing. Second, you got neurological dysfunction. Third, you have memory issues. And then fourth, you have attentional catch-up. Now, one of the first things I think we should mention is that it can be kind of difficult to understand the causes of déjà vu because déjà vu is inherently a little bit difficult to study. It's not super easy to trigger episodes of déjà vu in a laboratory or brain imaging context. There are some techniques we can mention, but you can't just like start up an fMRI and then run it and hope somebody has an experience of déjà vu while it's running. Remember, like déjà vu is relatively rare. Most people experience it at some point in their life. But I think, you know, an average figure is that a lot of people say they have a déjà vu experience something like once a year. So you couldn't expect for it to just happen while you're looking for it.
Yeah, déjà vu is not really the sort of thing you can just have on command. Nobody can say, all right, have some déjà vu. And likewise, it's not that I don't think I've seen any evidence or any claims of anybody who could produce a feeling of déjà vu just by willing it, though we will get into some unique cases a little later.
Right. That would be an interesting skill if one had it. Now, there are some cases where it appears that déjà vu can be triggered by certain clinical interventions. We mentioned a couple of cases of it being associated with certain combinations of drugs in the last episode, like a couple of drugs used to treat the flu. Also by, no big surprise here, electrical stimulation of the brain. In his big review, Brown describes findings about déjà vu and brain stimulation in patients with temporal lobe epilepsy. Again, remember from last time that déjà vu is one of the symptoms that has been described as part of the aura preceding an epileptic seizure in people with temporal lobe epilepsy. But another thing about temporal lobe epilepsy is that in some cases in history, electrical stimulation of the brain has been used in the treatment and diagnosis of temporal lobe epilepsy. I want to read a section from Brown here writing about this. Brown writes, quote, "With surface stimulation of the cortex," and that's electrical stimulation, "Mullen and Penfield elicited déjà vu experiences in 10 out of 217 people with temporal lobe epilepsy. Recent procedures involving deep electrode brain implantation have shown that déjà vu, similar to one that occurs in the aura, can be elicited with stimulation of the amygdala and hippocampus. Although these experiences were not reported in detail, the déjà vu generally consisted of a sudden feeling of unfamiliarity in the hospital environment and was often accompanied by epigastric phenomena and fear." And epigastric phenomena refers to strange feelings in the abdomen, especially I think the upper part of the abdomen. I've read it described as getting a feeling sort of above the stomach and right below the chest, like this weird feeling kind of like when you're on a roller coaster and you're plummeting down on the other side, you know, that rising in the gut.
Yeah, I believe we discussed that a little bit in the last episode.
Brown writes, quote, "The elicitation of déjà vu through electrical stimulation may not be reliable. Halgren et al. In 1978 stimulated several dozen brain locations in a group of people with temporal lobe epilepsy on two different occasions, 2 weeks apart, and found that a number of sites that elicited a déjà vu on one session did not do so on the other. Déjà vu experiences also resulted from stimulating the non-diseased hemisphere, suggesting that the experience is not necessarily specific to the tissue where the seizure originates." So that's interesting. You've got déjà vu associated in some cases with people with temporal lobe epilepsy, but that it appears like if you stimulate one part of the brain 1 week and it gives you déjà vu, but a different part of the brain the next week, that might give you déjà vu. And maybe the original place that gave you déjà vu last week doesn't give it to you anymore. So there's some kind of discontinuity here about how exactly stimulating different parts of the brain contribute to the déjà vu experience subjectively. But there have been some other interesting things that I know we'll get to later in the episode of trying to trigger déjà vu in otherwise neurologically typical people. For example, using certain types of virtual reality stimulation I think we'll get to that maybe in the third part of today's episode. But I guess we got to get directly to these four main theories explaining what could be going on in the brain when you're having déjà vu, assuming it's not like a supernatural phenomenon, which we don't think it is. There's a good amount of evidence that it is a function of the brain. So
right, the ghost hypothesis is really not highly valued in scientific circles here.
Yeah, so we won't be picking up on that one today. But so again, these are the four main branches that Brown outlines are dual processing, neurological dysfunction, memory error, and attentional catch-up. And I'll go ahead and say that I think the main two branches that have explanatory power going for them today, at least as far as I can tell, are the last two I mentioned, like the memory ones and the attentional ones. But since the other two have been very important in the history of studying deja vu, we should at least talk about them for a bit. So the first one is this idea of dual processing. There are these multiple hypotheses that fall into this category, but they all basically amount to the same thing. They say, you know, there are two different processes in the brain that usually occur simultaneously. They happen at the same time, but occasionally they become asynchronous. They get detached in time, and suddenly there's a lag between them. And these types of explanations tend to be the oldest and least scientifically justified, but they are kind of interesting to think about. So, for example, one that Brown cites is the idea of this old theory of dual consciousness. The idea was that there are two separate types of consciousness in the brain. There's one normal type of consciousness, and what that does is monitor everything that happens in the outside world. It's, you know, your regular brain that's looking out through your eyes and sees what's going on. And then the other version is the parasitic consciousness, which we might refer to as metacognition. It monitors the internal state of the brain itself. And under this old hypothesis, déjà vu is created when normal consciousness is impaired by something like fatigue or stress, and it's left up to the parasitic consciousness to evaluate incoming information. And because the parasitic consciousness is not well adapted to evaluating incoming information, it gets confused, and it confuses what it's looking at now for a memory of the past. While I like this idea, this one appears to be entirely speculative. It's mostly based on like 19th century conceptions of the mind and brain, so I don't think this one is very likely a good explanation today. Now, another one in this branch would be like encoding and retrieval. Brown says this was proposed by Dinayer in 1979, and basically it takes the form of a metaphor of the brain as a combination tape recorder and player. Did you have one of those when you were a kid, Robert?
Oh, yeah, of course.
But yeah, okay, so the metaphor here by Dinayer is that your brain has a combination tape recorder and player, and Brown explains this well, so I'm going to quote from him. Quote, "Under normal conditions, memory encoding and retrieval operate in a manner similar to the record and playheads, respectively, on a tape recorder. Either the record encode or the play retrieve head can be on, but not both at once. On rare occasions, the tape machine in a person's memory has both record and playheads active simultaneously during a new experience, creating a false sense of familiarity for the newly encoded experience."
So basically, the idea is that you are experiencing the memory as it is happening, which sounds paradoxical, but the idea of encoding and retrieving happening at the same time.
Yeah, and so Brown says this hypothesis never really got developed beyond just this metaphorical stage. Like, he never, you know, got into the nitty-gritty of, like, what parts of the brain this would exactly be involving and how it would work. But I would say, while it is still at this metaphorical stage, this is kind of close to some later explanations that are backed up by more empirical research. I think it's not quite on the money, but it's getting part of the way there. I think especially with some of the ones that we'll talk about with attention later on.
Yeah, and I also like how it kind of helps to further break down the nature of something that is novel and something that is familiar, and how it basically works, in our experience of cognitive data.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me think about how, in a way, there's almost no real objective thing that is novelty, you know, that like every time you're looking at anything in the world, in a way, it's sort of novel because like your head's in a different position, and you like, even if you're looking at something you've looked at 1,000 times before, the light's kind of different, you're looking at it from a slightly different angle. The brain just does a very good job taking things that are, you know, different data sets coming in through the eyes or the ears or whatever it is and saying like, okay, you know what that is. That's the same coffee cup you've looked at 1,000 times, even though it's not a photo exact copy of how it looked the last time you looked at it.
Yeah. I mean, as sense data goes, the details of the coffee cup are not that important. And the brain does a pretty good job in working with the senses of letting that kind of fade into the background. But then, you know, any day you're liable to pick up that coffee cup and really focus on it and kind of see it for the first time. And that's one of the crazy things about the close relationship between the novel and the familiar.
Yeah, and that emphasizes that, like, novel and familiar, they're not objective features of the world. They're, like, subjective simulations.
Yeah. This is almost an example of this, but not quite. I've had an Xbox One controller for so long, and I just discovered you can plug headphones into the controller itself to get sound. It's changed my life here in, self-isolation.
Oh, no, late in the night, your house is not filled with tiny screams that...
right. Yeah, if I want to play Doom Eternal at a weird hour, I can be the only one to hear it. Likewise, my son is trying out Minecraft for the first time, and we can plug him into the controller. And then if he jerks the controller around, he's not pulling things off of the TV tray or something. So this is an example of, I don't know how many times I've looked at this device, but I've never seen this detail. And, a lot of things in life are like that. You know, when you really, really stop to look at it, you can uncover the novel wrinkles in the thing.
I might want to come back to this example later in the episode, maybe when we talk about the memory and attentional branches. Okay, two more examples of dual processing hypotheses. So another one Brown cites is the idea of perception and memory. Seems kind of similar to the last one. It was proposed by a researcher named Bergson. Basically, it supposes that perception and memory formation happen at the same time. Like, you know, I look at Gritty, the Philadelphia Flyers mascot, for the first time. My brain sees him. It creates a memory of having seen him simultaneously. Bergson suggests that sometimes stress or fatigue can cause the newly formed memory to bump into perception so that I get the feeling that I have seen Gritty before. Again, this one is kind of fuzzy and speculative as far as hypotheses go.
Well, you know, we all feel that we've seen Gritty before because Gritty was with us in the womb. Gritty is primordial.
Yeah, Gritty was there before we were born. You know that's going to happen one day, like a big block of shale shears away from a Cambrian formation and then just the outline of Gritty there among all the trilobites. He was waiting the whole time. Okay, but then the fourth one of these dual processing hypotheses, this is the only one of the four that really seemed all that plausible to me. So this one is called familiarity and retrieval, and this was proposed by a researcher named Glure in 1990, and Glure suggested that when we encounter an image or an object or scenario or whatever it is that we've seen before, there are two separate things that happen. One is the retrieval of the past memories about that thing. So I see Gritty, I have seen him before, and I remember the other times I saw Gritty and had thoughts about him. But the other thing is the emotion of familiarity that accompanies the recall. So I see Gritty, I have memories, but also I have a feeling, it's this emotional feeling that, oh, I know who that is. That is Gritty. I feel familiar with what's going on right now. And from what I can tell, there's not really any direct evidence for this hypothesis, but this one does seem kind of plausible to me because we've talked about other cases of mismatch between recognition and familiarity. For example, in talking about Capgras delusion, I think we mentioned in part one, which is this delusion often caused by brain injury in which a person believes that their loved ones have been replaced by lookalikes or doppelgangers. And it's believed that Capgras delusion stems from a malfunction in the brain where recognition is triggered. So you see a person and you know who you're looking at. You're like, oh, yes, you know, that is Jeff. But the normally accompanying feeling of familiarity is not there. It doesn't get triggered. So you see somebody you recognize as Jeff, but he does not feel familiar. It doesn't feel like your old friend. So you say, oh, he's been replaced by a lookalike. what's normally a case of dual processing here has been severed. So if a dual processing failure like this were actually an explanation for déjà vu, I think it would have to go the opposite way, right? It would have to go the opposite of Capgras delusion, where a feeling of familiarity is triggered while actual retrieval of associated memories is not. And along these lines, Capgras delusion would actually be more analogous to the inverse of déjà vu that we mentioned last time, jamais vu, in which a familiar object suddenly feels unfamiliar. But again, from what I can tell, this kind of explanation I think is perfectly possible, but I can't find direct experimental evidence for it. So I think it might just remain right now in the realm of like, yeah, maybe something like this could explain some cases of déjà vu, but we don't have strong evidence that these explanations are the right ones yet.
All right. Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. But when we come back, we will continue to explore some of the explanations for what may be going on with déjà vu.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my 3 young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we just talked about the first branch of possible explanations for déjà vu, probably the oldest branch of explanations, which was the idea of dual processing, that when you experience déjà vu, it's because two different things that normally happen in the at the same time in the brain get severed, and one happens after the other one, or they get, you know, one happens without the other one, and this causes this disconnect. The next branch of explanations that Alan S. Brown offers in his 2003 paper are neurological explanations. Now, the first one is seizures. We know that déjà vu is a, you know, not super common, but a recognized experience in the aura of people who have temporal lobe epilepsy. So what if normal déjà vu, that happens in, 60% of people at some point, is actually just a kind of mild seizure? A lot of people have proposed this over the years, but Brown says that the evidence for this does not appear to be very good. Though déjà vu is a feature of seizures for people with TLE, people with epilepsy in general are not more prone to everyday déjà vu than people without epilepsy, and people who experience more episodes of déjà vu than average are not any more prone to seizures than anybody else.
So again, we can't actually look at déjà vu as it's happening and compare it to, say, what's happening in the brain during a seizure, but we can look at frequency between these two sets of individuals.
Yeah, and so it just doesn't look like seizures are going to be a good explanation for déjà vu generally. It looks more like there might, déjà vu just happens to be one of the things that sometimes happens in the brain of somebody about to have a seizure, but it's not overall a generalized seizure phenomenon. Now, the other major neurological explanation that Brown cites is neural transmission delay, and this refers to a set of explanations where information traveling from the perceptual organ, such as the eye, it's traveling to different parts of the brain, and it gets delayed along one of those pathways by neuronal misfiring or some other malfunction. One example that's given is the two different hemispheres of the brain usually receive information at the same time, but what if one hemisphere realizes that you're looking at Gritty slightly after the other one does? And under this hypothesis, the delay causes a freshly perceived stimulus to be interpreted as old information because one part of the brain has already experienced it by the time it gets to the other part.
Well, this seems like a good place to move on to some of the additional explanations, because we're talking about old information. What is old information but a memory?
Yeah, exactly. So now we're getting into those were the two older branches. Now we're getting into the branches that I think are more favored among researchers today, the memory-based explanations, especially implicit memories and attentional explanations. Now, Robert, if we go to memory-based, I think you're going to get into this branch of explanations a little bit more when you talk about the research by Ann M. Cleary and Alexander B. Claxton later on. I saw you had something about that. So maybe we can talk more in depth about the memory-based explanations then, but just do a short version now. The gist here is that déjà vu is perhaps, maybe it has something to do with the way that memories are encoded and retrieved. So imagine you're in one of these déjà vu scenarios. Maybe you're going down a staircase into a basement in a house, and you suddenly get this flash like, oh, I've been here before, but you haven't been here before. What if when you're experiencing déjà vu on that staircase, you are remembering something you've seen before? It's just not this house. It's not the same thing you're looking at now. You're feeling familiarity because of some vague features of similarity that overlap with your current experience and some other memory that you are not directly accessing in full. Maybe when I experienced déjà vu of like running into a tree branch while playing in the yard, the feeling of familiarity with the scene comes from the fact that there was some other time I was playing in maybe a similar looking place or a place with similar spatial arrangements of objects, and my friends were standing around me in a similar kind of orientation, and maybe I was injured or fell down in some other way, except I don't explicitly recall that whole episode. I don't remember where it was or who was there or what happened. I just recall enough to recognize some basic congruities, and this leads to that strange feeling of familiarity with no obvious point of reference.
So almost as if the emotional pattern of something that occurred stuck with you, but the details of it did not. And that's what gets recalled.
Right, or details might have stuck with me in a way that doesn't allow me to access the full scene as a memory, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I think a common thing that's brought up in this kind of memory research is, like spatial arrangements of things. You know, like, if you feel déjà vu in a room, maybe you were not in that room before, but we're in a room where, like, the furniture was arranged in a very similar way, and you don't explicitly recall that old memory, but something gets triggered in, like, the navigation parts of your brain. Like, what's going on? I know this place.
Yeah, I mean, we do have to remind ourselves that as far as novelty goes in life, there's only so much novelty that is really possible to a certain extent. You know, I mean, even if you live a wild and varied life full of travel and exploring new things, you're going to encounter lots of situations that fit into more or less the same pattern. You know, you're going to go to a bathroom that looks a lot like other bathrooms. You're going to do things more or less the same way that you've done it before. I mean, we are creatures of habit. We are creatures of pattern. And for many things in life, there are only so many approaches to how we might react to something or carry something out.
Mm-hmm. No, novelty is total illusion, eternal recurrence. We've all been through this before.
Yeah, in fact, I think you've said that before.
No, I haven't. I don't really mean that. You know, and so I was thinking about this. I was thinking about, wow, this might sound like a weird way for the brain to work, that you could have this feeling of familiarity about a memory that you cannot explicitly recall. But I think there are analogies to this in things that we've discussed before. I was brought back to the idea of tip of the tongue phenomenon. We did a whole episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind about this. You know, this is where, hey, what's the name of the actor who played Riff Raff in Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Well, the correct answer is Richard O'Brien.
But there were some people listening right there who were like, oh, I know that. But you couldn't quite come up with it, right? Why is it that you can feel like you know a word or feel like you know a name, even though you can't conjure the word or the name up right now? Perhaps a similar thing happens with images or situations, kind of like a tip of the tongue effect for things other than words, for situations or for, you know, images you look at with your eyes. You feel like you recognize this scene, but you can't actually call up the memory that is causing that feeling of familiarity. So I think, and there is actually some research to back up certain memory-based explanations for some déjà vu experiences. So at least as far as I can tell, I think the memory-based explanations might not explain all déjà vu, but are a pretty strong candidate for explaining some cases of it.
All right, well, let's move on to attentional explanations, which I think is an exciting area because I think a lot of the mysteries of human consciousness make more sense to me when I hear them explained in terms of attention.
Yeah, me too. And I think this branch has a lot going for it. This is the fourth of four. And so these explanations are some of the most simple, actually, but they make a lot of sense to explain some cases of déjà vu. And there is actually some experimental evidence in support of them. So imagine you're driving a car, right? And maybe while you are driving, you're having a tense emotional conversation with the passenger of the car. Maybe it's, you know, your spouse or partner or, you know, your child or parent or relative. You're having an argument or something. So your attention is kind of divided, maybe. Like you're not paying as full attention to the road in front of you as you should be. Then suddenly you see a man in a cowboy hat pushing a grocery cart full of Monster Energy drinks down the sidewalk. And you think, whoa, déjà vu. Why do I feel like I've seen this guy before? Under the attentional model, the answer could be that you did see him before, a couple of seconds ago, but your attention was divided. And because you had your attention wrapped up in this intense conversation, and you weren't paying as much attention as you should have been to the road, you didn't consciously register seeing this guy a couple of seconds before. But you did see him with some diminished portion of your attention. And when you finally focus full attention on him, he feels familiar even though you're just now consciously registering him.
You know, in a way, this reminds me of a non déjà vu experience that I have sometimes where I'll run across a study or a paper that I maybe just glanced at in the past, or maybe I only read the headline, But now I've come back around to it and I'm reading it, you know, more closely, you know, and I'm actually taking it in. And then I realize, oh, I think I do vaguely remember this study from when it originally popped up.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, there's more of a time gap, right? So your memory, mm-hmm. I think, would be more accurate, actually. And I know right. exactly what you're talking about. I have that feeling, too, where, like, I sort of graze over something, you know, text content, and then I come back to it later, and it feels vaguely familiar, like out of a dream, because I didn't read it really closely the first time.
But this time, instead of it being, like, a gap of 5 years, it's a gap of, say, like, 5 seconds.
Exactly. In Brown's words, quote, "A brief initial perception of a scene under diminished attention is followed immediately by a second perception under full attention. The second impression matches that experienced moments earlier under degraded attention, and the individual does not consciously identify the prior experience as moments old, but rather attributes it to a more distant past." And I think that there's a lot of potential in this explanation. This could be what's going on in some of these cases.
Yeah, I feel like this one feels like it fits really well with a lot of deja vu experiences that I can relate to. I'm not sure that it fits as easily, or I think it may still fit, but perhaps with a little more sort of cognitive work to figure out how it fits with some of the other examples of the deja vu experience that we've either discussed or will discuss.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I would be strongly inclined to suspect that there are different explanations for different cases of deja vu, that there's not just like one trigger that creates all deja vu experiences, that it's, you know, just different kind of things going on. My gut feeling here is that probably some cases are best explained by the implicit memory thing that we were talking about a minute ago, and then other ones are better explained by the attentional divide thing. And then, of course, there are a few that are probably just direct neurological issues, like, you know, when the brain is being stimulated or when there's a seizure.
Now, I'd like to come back to the link between anxiety and deja vu, because I found a very interesting study on this. Apparently, there is somewhat limited literature on the connection between anxiety and deja vu, but one paper on the topic I came across was titled "Persistent Psychogenic Deja Vu: A Case Report," and this was by Wells, Moulin, and Etheridge, and it was published in the Journal of Medical Case Reports, and this was from 2014. So the researchers present the case of a 23-year-old British man with a form of persistent deja vu, and this is observed in 2010. He was 3 years into his symptoms at that point.
Wow.
So, if you're wondering, well, what is persistent deja vu? It's basically what it sounds like, but I think more of this will come across as I roll through briefly through his case history. So the subject here had a history of anxiety and depersonalization. Depersonalization, if anyone doesn't remember, is a state in which one's thoughts and feelings seem unreal or not to belong to oneself. And it may also entail a loss of all sense of identity. He also had a family history of obsessive compulsive disorder. So when doctors looked at him, they didn't detect any neurological abnormalities. And they assessed his recognition memory with tasks that were frequently used with dementia patients. And they found no memory defects. They found that he consistently understood the false nature of the deja vu he was experiencing as well, coming back to a key aspect of deja vu that we discussed in the first episode.
So his reality testing was basically intact as far as they could tell.
Yeah.
Like he didn't actually think that he was really having memories of the present.
Right. So the patient's history of anxiety was tied with fears of contamination, which led to excessive hand washing and showers 2 to 3 times a day. And then college anxiety made things worse. So he took a break from it and he began to experience episodes of anxiety and deja vu that would last for minutes or even longer. Mm. They point out that he went on holiday at one point during this period to a city that he had visited before. So he did have prior, you know, memories of having been there, but he felt as if he had become, quote, trapped in a time loop the whole time. And the experience was apparently somewhat terrifying. So even though he knew, okay, I'm not actually in a time loop, it feels like I'm in a time loop. I know I'm not, but it's really still terrifying to experience.
Totally. Ooh.
All right. And then he returned to college in 2007 and during this time tried the psychedelic compound LSD.
Okay.
And they write, quote, "From then on, the deja vu was fairly continuous." So quick note for everyone, as you'll remember from our, five-part series on psychedelics, this would seem to fall in line with the observation that the psychedelic experience can, for individuals with a predisposition, exacerbate a psychological condition. Typically, one hears about this in regards to schizophrenia. So at this point, our subject is experiencing near constant deja vu. So he goes to see a specialist. They found that he was experiencing anxiety and low mood, but for the most part, everything was normal. I think his dissociative event scale score was slightly abnormal, but otherwise it was just this deja vu effect. And interestingly enough, they write that he took to avoiding music and TV because he would invariably feel that he had seen or heard the material before. And then this would play into his deja vu experience or would make it more pronounced. And I found this to be interesting, this idea, because this gets back to the idea of the novel and the familiar, because if deja vu is largely the experience of the novel as familiar, then would extreme cases like this require one to just try to avoid novel things as much as possible?
Just surround yourself with what's actually familiar so that when it feels familiar, it doesn't feel unusual. I mean, this case sounds really disturbing because I don't normally think of deja vu as something that is inherently unpleasant. When I feel it, it is strange, but it's not, it doesn't hurt, it's not in itself, worrying or upsetting, but I can absolutely see how if it persisted over time, it could take on that character.
Yeah, I mean, a sneeze isn't that bad, but we wouldn't want to sneeze constantly. And I would say that like a typical deja vu experience for me, and I think for most people, is far less distracting than a sneeze. However, I will say that those experiences that I related in the first episode that I had recently, those were more potent. Those were certainly more powerful, and I certainly would not want to feel that all the time either. So the researchers in this case, though, they propose that the form of deja vu described here, it might more accurately be described as deja vicu, this particularly strong sensation of reliving the present moment. Quote, "He complained that it felt like he was actually retrieving previous experiences from memory, not just finding them familiar." They concluded, quote, "It is plausible on neurobiological grounds that anxiety might lead to the generation of deja vu. The hippocampal formation, a structure of central importance in declarative memory and the ability to engage in recollection, is also implicated in anxiety as part of the septo-hippocampal system. Although this report does not prove a link between anxiety and deja vu, it does further support the suggestion that this area is worthy of further investigation."
That's very interesting. It makes me think about the link between deja vu and stress or fatigue. Now, I'm not sure exactly how to separate out stress and anxiety. I think there's a good deal of overlap between stress and anxiety, but they're not exactly the same thing.
Right. Yeah, it's often the case with human emotions and experience. There's kind of a delicate web where all these things, sometimes conflicting things, are and seem to be in rather close proximity to each other.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, let's take one more break. But when we come back, we'll discuss deja vu and dreams.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question. Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
All right, we're back. Now, Robert, I remember a little while ago, we got an email from a listener who wanted us to look into the issue of Deja Rev, right?
Yeah. I believe that this was a listener by the name of Anne. She brought up, well, I'll just read a part from the email here. Quote, several months ago, I was introduced to the term déjà rêve. I first thought it was the speaker's mispronunciation of déjà vu. However, it's an independent concept. Déjà rêve literally translates to already dreamed. It's the sensation that one has experienced a real-time event in a previous dream. It can be considered a form of precognition. I would love to learn a scientific perspective and explanation for this phenomena. So that sounds like a great idea, Anne. Let's look into it.
Okay. Well, you know, I will say just from a personal perspective, when I experience déjà vu, I don't know if my brain makes a distinction between déjà vu and déjà vécu and déjà rêve. Like, it seems like when I get that feeling of familiarity in a situation, I couldn't tell the difference between whether I'm feeling like I already have been here or feeling like I've already been here in a dream. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I hear what you're saying there. I feel like with my experience, I do sort of see there's the feeling of it. There's kind of like that deja vu energy that, you know, intensity factors aside may essentially be the same. But then in some cases, I am instantly aware that it is somehow tied to external sense data. And in other cases, particularly these stronger feelings that I've had, they seem to be tied to internal feelings or thoughts,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess the feeling of déjà vu for me is inherently kind of dreamlike. Mm-hmm. It suddenly in waking life creates a little bit of an aura of the feeling one has in dreams.
Oh, yeah.
And so it naturally to me kind of suggests, like, when I have that feeling of anomalous familiarity, I'm like, did I dream this before? But I accept that maybe in other people there is this clearer distinction, like that there's one type of feeling like I've already been here in waking life, and the other one is like I already experienced this in a dream. It's just for me they've never felt all that distinct from each other.
Okay. Well, let's look at a paper here. I'm going to refer to Frequency of Deja Rev, Effects of Age, Gender, Dream Recall, and Personality by, this is Sredel, Goritz, and Funkhauser. We mentioned Funkhauser in the last episode, published in the Journal of Consciousness Studies in 2017. Now, as we've discussed already, you can broadly say, all right, there's deja vu. But then when you really get down into it, there's sort of different subsections to deja vu. And so you have things like deja rev that come up. Well, according to Dr. Vernon Nipp in his 1983 book, The Psychology of Deja Vu, and subsequent publications in which he wrote about deja vu, there are perhaps 20 different forms of the deja experience. And man, I'm not going to read them all, but there are some really good ones. There's like deja su, already known intellectually. There's deja dit, already said or spoken. So, you know, referring to a content of speech. Basically, they get into all the different nuances of how you might interact with the world or with your own brain. Like there's one for already hallucinated, mm-hmm. one for already eaten.
Déjà mange.
Yeah, déjà mange. That would be a great one to just shout out in a restaurant as you are enjoying a meal. Uh-huh. But then indeed, one of the...
I'm thinking of The Sopranos, where like Tony is like, you mange Uncle June, but then Uncle June is like, whoa, déjà mange.
Oh, man, there's déjà musique, already heard or played specific music. And then this one's really fat. I haven't looked into this one in greater depth, but déjà paradoxy, basically already paradoxical, which that just sounds kind of mind-rendering, to encounter a paradox and then have a déjà vu about that paradox.
Uh-huh. I can't even think of an example of what that
would be. Yeah, we'll have to come back to that one. Maybe you, the listener, have an example of a déjà paradox experience that you can share with us. But anyway, the main focus of this paper was the déjà rev experience and the idea of feeling as if you have dreamt something before. And I think some of us can probably relate to that with our déjà vu. You know, you might think, weird, I feel like I have dreamt this before. And perhaps some of us feel that more strongly than others. Incidentally, Funkhauser, one of the authors here, points out on his website, dejaexperienceresearch.org. That's with hyphens in there, deja-experience-research.org. He points out that Percy Shelley wrote of the connection between déjà vu and dreams, though his thoughts were not published till after his death.
Mm.
So here's the quote. "The scene was a common scene. The effect that it produced on me was not such as could have been expected. I suddenly remembered to have seen that exact scene in some dream of long. Here I was obliged to leave off, overcome by thrilling horror."
Wow.
But back to this study in particular, they point out that as a blanket explanation for déjà vu, this one, you know, dates back quite a long ways. One of the earliest explanations for the déjà experience, I think we mentioned this, the first one was when St. Augustine wrote of it in the year 416. And then Sir Walter Scott much later writes about it in the year 1815. But the authors of this paper, they set out to perform a survey of the experience. Now, this was a survey of 444 people, asking them about their experiences of déjà vu, specifically déjà rev, the association between this feeling of déjà vu and their dreams. And so out of the 444 individuals that responded, it's interesting. So first of all, there was the frequency. Now, in the study, they break it down a little more in a little more detail. But basically, they found that 95% of the people sampled said that, yes, they did experience déjà rev. Now, how often they experienced it varied quite a bit. For instance, 4.8% said that they just never experienced it. But in terms of those that did, like, you know, you had like 41 said that they experienced it less than once a year. But then there were 8 individuals, which is only 1.8% of the individuals polled here. They experienced it several times a week.
Wow. Well, yeah. I'm curious how this squares with previous research finding that, you know, up to something like a third of people, or maybe up to 40% of people in some of these older surveys, report having never had any experience of déjà vu. I wonder what's going on, because you talk to people nowadays, that figure seems kind of high. I would figure that, you know, close to, you know, nearly everybody has had like at least some kind of déjà vu experience at some point. But these older surveys, you know, have it still very common, but lower. I wonder if there used to be more of a stigma or kind of weird paranormal association with saying that you've had déjà vu. Does that make sense? Like maybe if people didn't think that there could be any kind of like normal explanation for it, they'd be less likely to want to admit it and talk about it.
Like their gender norms about it, perhaps, like a real man doesn't have déjà vu, or a proper lady never experiences déjà vu. It is simply not done. Something to that effect. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. You can't be a cowboy if you got déjà vu.
It's true. I've never... I don't think even Cormac McCarthy considered déjà vu and the American cowboy.
Well, no, I'm just curious. Maybe there's something I'm missing here. It just seems like in these older surveys, fewer people admitted to having déjà vu.
Now, with this particular study, I should note that the authors admit, quote, the high incidence of déjà rev, again, about 95% in this sample, might be explained by the fact that the sample consists mainly of psychology students who consider such phenomena as interesting and related to their chosen profession.
That is, well, okay, that makes a lot of sense, that in these surveys, we may be getting a less randomized, more rarefied sample of, like, the kind of people who are more likely to remember these experiences and want to talk about them.
Yeah, just more likely to be introspective about your own inner reality. Mm-hmm. They also point out that the previously noted in other studies association between déjà rev and dream recall frequency seems, on one hand, plausible. Okay, so if we're making the connection between this déjà experience and dreams, a person with high dream recall might be more likely to attribute déjà vu experiences to prior dreams. However, quote, the impression of having dreamed the actually occurring events arises within that moment and usually cannot be attributed to a particular dream in the past, even if the person's kept dream diaries in order to document the dreams prior to the déjà rev experience.
I think that squares with the overall anomalous familiarity phenomenon. Like when you have déjà vu, the whole point is that you can't relate it to a specific experience in your memory. It's just the general feeling that I've seen this before. And that seems to go along with the dream phenomenon as well.
I also came across a 2015 paper that that basically found that déjà rev experiences are common after electric brain stimulation, standard treatment for epileptic symptoms. They looked at three different subsets of déjà rev: episodic, so you know, with a direct connection made to a specific dream; half-remembered scenes that echoed their current circumstances; and an even dreamier-like state in which the experience itself is dream or nightmare-like. So I felt that cast a little more perspective on what may be going on here. So let's again remind everyone, déjà vu, the experience that something novel is actually familiar. So imagine this. Imagine feeling this as you walk down a new hallway and you're about to open a door to an office you've never visited before. You feel at least for a second there, for this fleeting moment, that you know what will be on the other side. Now, this is just a feeling, but it feels real to the people who experience it. It feels like in this moment of déjà vu, you are able to see the future.
Yeah. And in fact, some people, I think this is one of the reasons that a lot of people have been kind of insistent on viewing déjà vu as some kind of actual paranormal phenomenon and not just like a strange feature of the brain, that sometimes people feel like they are actually getting information about the future from it, you know, that like, yeah, I know what's going to happen next.
And really this does, I think, feel like this kind of thing adds another wrinkle to our understanding of people who claim to have precognitive abilities or experiences in their life, you know, because if you're taking just like the hard skeptical approach to that, then it's like, okay, some people are crazy, some people are scammers, maybe some people are both of those, but But this, by thinking about the link between deja vu and precognition, you could well have a situation where someone, you know, maybe they're more inclined to engage in supernatural ideas or some sort of religious model that incorporates precognition. But if you had just at least a few flashes of this sort of experience, like a moment where you're like, yeah, I know what's going to be on the other side of that door. And even if it ends up to not be the case, you know, you still had that feeling that felt so real.
Well, this seems like the kind of thing that you could actually put to the test if only you could create scenarios. We talked earlier about the difficulty of creating deja vu on command. It's obviously not easy to do. But if you could put together a test where you could sort of try to stimulate deja vu-like experiences in people, you could actually put this to the test, right? You could find out, well, wait, do people have any additional predictive power?
All right, well, let's jump into this particular study that I have lined up here. So this is a 2018 study that was published in Psychological Science, and it was titled Deja Vu, an Illusion of Prediction. And this was by Anne M. Cleary, who we mentioned earlier, and Alexander B. Claxton. So Cleary has put a great deal of research into deja vu, as well as tip of the tongue over the years, and her working hypothesis is that it's a, quote, particular manifestation of familiarity. Something feels familiar when you paradoxically feel that it shouldn't. In her last 10 years plus of research, she started hearing a lot about people's claims to the precognition feeling, you know, again, not the reality of predicting the future, but the feeling, the confidence that you know what is going to occur. And she wanted to see if, as she suspected, the feeling was a memory phenomenon as well. And of course, the added complication here for her is that, you know, memory does aid us in our ability to predict future events. So it's far from a trivial question. Memory isn't just there to make you feel good or bad about the past. It's about survival moving forward. So what did they do? Well, we've discussed some of the issues with trying to recreate deja vu in the lab. So their approach here was to basically pull it off via virtual reality based on past studies that found out that subjects were more likely to report deja vu among scenes that spatially mapped onto earlier witness scenes. Subjects were put through familiar virtual hallways and then asked if they felt deja vu or premonition at key turns. So, you know, this is a situation where you can just imagine, you know, Doom and Wolfenstein kind of hallways, you know, virtual hallways, and some of the same mapping, but a different feel, a different look. And then the researchers would jump in at key points and see if there was a sense of deja vu or premonition on the part of the subject. And these were their findings. About half the respondents felt a strong premonition during deja vu. However, they were no more likely to actually recall the correct answer than mere chance would explain. So that's not to say that the take home here is that deja vu experiencers are not precogs. We know that. We knew that going in. But rather that it creates an illusion of certainty, confidence in the choice that might be linked to stuff like hindsight bias. Now, her work on all this continues. There's a, you know, great deal more that could be learned about the deja experience. But I think this is really interesting because, again, you can see how this might form the bedrock for greater beliefs in precognition and predictions of the future. You know, you build upon this with some sort of existing religious, supernatural, magical script about individuals who can sense the future. And it seems like one would support the other rather well.
Sure.
All right. So there you have it. We're going to go ahead and call it here. We hope you enjoyed our 2-episode look at the deja vu experience, all that it seems to incorporate, and some of our best attempts to understand it, though those attempts are still very much in process. The work continues. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Wherever that happens to be, make sure you rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our awesome audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.